Several weeks into the tenure of the Biden administration, many people are looking at the U.S.-China economic and trade relationship and trying to divine where things are going to go in 2021 and over the course of the Biden presidency. Over the last 2 or 3 years, there has been increasing discussion about the possibility of a U.S.-China decoupling. Meanwhile, both countries are focused on reviving their economies in the wake of the huge COVID-19 hit of 2020. Given these challenges and the recent change of U.S. administrations, the United States and China are now at something of a crossroads. What does the economic future look like for the two countries? And how will the United States-China economic and trade relationship bear on the global economy in 2021 and over the coming several years? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to examine the economic relationship between the United States and China is noted academic Dr. Stephen Roach. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's a great topic and important that we discuss it.
Stephen is a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs and senior lecturer at Yale's School of Management. He formerly served as chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia and as the firm's chief economist. His current teaching and research program at Yale focuses on the impact of Asia on the broader global economy. Stephen has long been one of Wall Street's most influential economists, and his work has appeared in academic journals, books, congressional testimony, and major media. Stephen is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, before we drill down on the U.S.-China relations issues, could you share your take on where the U.S., Chinese, and global economies are today and the degree to which we are on the road to recovery in the wake of the major COVID-19 hit of last year?
Certainly. The worst is behind us. We had an unprecedented sudden stop in the world as the public health crisis caused an extraordinary lockdown of all major economies in early 2020. As the lockdown ended in the spring, sooner in some places like China, there was a snapback. It's sort of like a rubber band. You pull it down far enough and you let it go, and there's a huge snapback. The snapback is now being reinforced by massive, unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus, which is fueling a significant boom in the world. The question I have, David, though, is once the medicine has its impact, what will it be like when we stop applying this stimulus? I'm more cautious than most, thinking that a lot of the boom that we're seeing now and likely to see in the months ahead might borrow from growth that might have otherwise occurred later this year in early 2022. We'll know that soon enough, but I think it's going to be difficult to sustain the type of vigor that we're seeing around the world in perpetuity.
So looking out to the rest of the year, Stephen, net-net, would you be able to say that you are optimistic, neutral, or pessimistic in light of the different considerations that you've laid out as to where the economy will be by the end of 2021?
I'm optimistic near term, but more cautious medium to longer term.
Let me ask you this, Stephen. The IMF projects that the Chinese economy will recover faster than that of any other country in 2021. And my question for you is, why is that? And what has China done that other countries evidently haven't done?
Well, China was first to recognize that its economy was being hit by a public health crisis. And many would say, well, you know, it's China's fault. Of course, they should have recognized it first. This is not about holding China accountable for what has truly been a global pandemic that we all have suffered from. But by treating the pandemic as the main source of economic disruption, China moved much more aggressively than the rest of the world into closing down activity, moving to massive testing, mask wearing, and taking its medicine first. And then it was able to contain the virus much, much more effectively than we in the United States or in Europe did, and manage a cautious but disciplined economic recovery after containment. So they did the right thing in recognizing and in addressing the virus. For us, containment and mitigation became a political battle, and we suffered hugely for that as we remained in denial. And now that we're moving aggressively to contain the virus through the miracles of medicine, we're coming out the other side, but in a much more belated fashion than was the case in China.
Over the past few months, Stephen, you have expressed in a number of interviews concern over the depreciation of the U.S. dollar. Tell us what is happening there and what it means for the United States and our economic relationship with China and also for the global financial system.
Well, David, my point on the dollar is, number one, the dollar has been strong for a number of years and typically is stronger than weaker, but it's gone through three prior significant declines in the past 50 years. It was very weak throughout the 70s, weak again in the mid-80s, and weak for the first decade of the 2000s. Those three earlier drops averaged to about 31% on a broad index basis. And I expressed the view last June that the dollar was headed for another sharp decline comparable to those, if not slightly larger than those three earlier instances. And I expressed that view for three reasons. One, a widening balance of payments deficit. Two, a Federal Reserve that was going to keep its monetary policy unchanged, even in the face of economic recovery and an apparent rise in inflation. And thirdly, that there were alternatives to the dollar that most were in denial of, including the Chinese currency, the renminbi, the euro, the most unloved major currency in the world. And even at the time, this seemed a little bit foolish, but cryptocurrencies. And so that remains my view. The dollar is down, has fallen about 12% since I first expressed that forecast. It's rallied about 2 percentage points back in the last few weeks, but I still think there's a lot more to come on the downside of the dollar, and that does raise questions for investors and for the global economy.
And just on a related note, Stephen, do you have a sense through your contacts with Chinese counterparts as to how the Chinese view this phenomenon that you've described?
Well, I think, you know, the Chinese are prepared as they continue to move down the road of reform for further increases in the value of their own currency, the renminbi or the yuan. In the broad sense, measuring the Chinese currency relative to a large basket of China's trading partners, you know, their currency has been up over 50% since 1994. So they know what their strong economy and their opening up of their financial system means for the value of the currency. And to the extent that the U.S. is now moving into a period where there is significant downward pressure on the dollar for some of the reasons that I just laid out to you, David, this will not come as a huge surprise to Chinese authorities.
Staying on the related topic of the currency, both the United States and China have declared a desire to create a digital currency. Can you share with us where the two countries are on this now? And looking at this from an American perspective, should China's declared interest in moving in this direction be viewed as a challenge or a potential challenge to the United States or U.S. leadership in the world in terms of the global economy?
I don't think so. I think China's certainly leading the charge in its central bank supporting a digital currency. But in large part, this is by necessity rather than by design, unlike the U.S., which has, you know, a very large digital infrastructure payments mechanism already in place that is not the case with respect to China. They have a couple of internet companies, Alibaba with its Alipay system, and the WeChat WePay system, that are conducting a large volume of transactions. And the central bank wants to make certain that they have control over these payment systems. And I think their move to digitization is more a reflection of that rather than some grand design to take over the world financial system.
Let me move over to a really important issue now in the U.S.-China relationship, and that's the topic of technology. Last week, a bipartisan U.S. Commission on Artificial Intelligence issued a report, and the commission's chair, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, argued in congressional testimony that, quote, the threat of Chinese leadership in key technology areas is a national crisis, unquote. He also said, quote, we will need a hybrid approach that more tightly aligns government and private sector efforts to win, unquote. And Stephen, the question I want to ask you is, are we seeing a fundamental shift in American economic philosophy and strategy as to how best to compete with China in the technology domain? And to what degree might we see the trend toward national industrial policy and a much more substantial role for the federal government in commercial matters, a trend that started in earnest under the Trump administration, continue under the Biden administration?
Well, number one, I would dispute your contention that this trend started in earnest under the Trump administration. There was a lot of bluster and a lot of charges and countercharges that went back and forth, but it's not clear to me that there was really a meaningful attempt at formulating a competitive strategy during the last 4 years. But having said that, I think the artificial intelligence review that was conducted by this commission headed up by Eric Schmidt, who I have an enormous amount of respect for, made it very clear that America has some serious issues that it must face and contend with in this all-encompassing technology. We certainly were innovators in some of the basic research that has laid the groundwork for a lot of the algorithmic breakthroughs that are now known under the general rubric of artificial intelligence. But in an open architecture internet, you know, these algorithms are, you know, not nearly as proprietary as we would like to think. And so many others around the world, including the Chinese, certainly are now equally adept at the skill set that these breakthroughs provide. Where the Chinese have enormous advantage is sort of in the next phase of AI-enabled applications, and that's through massive data and levering that database into applications. And, you know, one of the best students of artificial intelligence is a Taiwanese, U.S. educated and U.S. experienced expert on AI, Kai-Fu Lee, who's written a book about this battle for AI supremacy. And he argues that, you know, we're in the next phase right now, driven by data, driven by applications. And the Chinese, while they were disadvantaged in phase one, are now have the clear advantage in phase two. And that's something that we need to take very seriously. And Eric Schmidt's commission is an important wake-up call in that regard.
And Stephen, thank you. And just to clarify my earlier point, my point was less that the Trump administration had a particularly coherent policy or strategy in this area, but more that the Trump administration seemed to me to be much more comfortable inserting the federal government into decision-making that used to be seen as really being within the domain of the private sector. And we see that in terms of some of the legislation and some of the executive orders that were issued that brought the federal government into the boardroom and the corporate C-suite in a way that I don't recall that we've seen generally in the modern era in the United States. So that was more what I was trying to communicate. But let me turn to this topic of decoupling, which has certainly become a prevalent theme in discourse on the U.S.-China economic relationship over the last couple of years. What is your take on the notion of U.S.-China decoupling? Is it desirable, as some people seem to believe, from a U.S. vantage? Is it even feasible in any meaningful sense?
The answer is no, it's not desirable. The relationship between the two nations that has been in place on the economic sphere really since the 1980s has worked to the advantage of both nations. And the pressures that have been brought to bear on this relationship over the last 4 years through tariffs and sanctions and other types of intimidation and threats has backfired. It's counterproductive. It has not worked. And it's based on a flawed framework of assessment in that while the U.S. has a large trade deficit with China, it's only one of 102 bilateral trade deficits that we have with nations all over the world. And we have a multilateral trade imbalance because we don't save as a nation. And so lacking in saving and wanting to grow, we have to import surplus savings from abroad, and we run these big multilateral trade deficits. So if you cut off trade with China, as the decoupling school wants you to believe, in an effort to protect American workers and communities, then the Chinese piece just goes somewhere else. And David, if you look at the pieces of our trade deficit country by country over the last couple of years since the trade war was launched, that's exactly what's happened. The trade deficit hasn't gotten smaller. It's just gone away from China to higher cost foreign suppliers. And that's the functional equivalent of a tax hike on American families, on American workers. So we need to rethink this notion of decoupling. In the same sense, there's a lot of issues that were correctly put on the table by the Trump administration in the area of intellectual property, innovation policy, forced technology transfer, subsidies to state-owned enterprises, cybersecurity. Those are all issues that we need to engage in, but not in the form of a trade war based on, I think, a reckless imposition of tariffs.
Well, Stephen, let me just say, I really appreciate all the points that you've made, and I absolutely agree with everything that you've just said. Let me ask you this, Stephen, at a broader kind of almost economic philosophy level, to what degree do you sense that we in the United States are seeing a kind of rejection of the very construct of comparative advantage, which has generally been the basis for our approach to trade in the modern era in this country? And it seems to me that we now see people saying, whatever the costs and whatever, to whatever degree it makes little economic sense, we nevertheless need to bring things back to the United States. Isn't that a rejection of the very concept of comparative advantage?
Well, it is, David. I think, you know, that's a good way to put it. And comparative advantage has been, it was developed centuries ago by David Ricardo in a world that was much more simple than is the case today. But it's been a powerful framework to understand how countries can gain from trade if they do, in fact, migrate to manufactured and even tradable services that they are best endowed to deliver into the global marketplace. So the idea of nationalism, Trump called it America First, is in direct conflict with what the theory of comparative advantage has enabled us and others in the world to benefit from over a long period of time. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be rigorous and tough in making certain that we and all of our trading partners do in fact trade in a way that it conforms with the principles of free trade as we understand them and are adjudicated by international bodies such as the World Trade Organization. But to toss out the theory under the sort of political mantra of America First, I think was a serious political economy blunder.
Stephen, before we turn to the Biden administration and its approach to China, let me just ask you one other particular question that relates to this theme that we're talking about. And that is, what do you see happening this year and over the near term with respect to global supply chains To what degree are U.S. companies moving operations out of China, particularly now that we're on the other side of the Trump administration? What are you seeing there?
Well, the supply chain issue is a new and important twist in understanding the way that trade works, the way that globalization works, and the way that nations depend upon one another. What we learned painfully through COVID is we may have taken too much slack out of our supply chains and left ourselves vulnerable to shortages of supplies of sorely needed medical equipment, ingredients for pharmaceuticals. And some of that supply chain deficiency is still evident today, believe it or not, as we continue to grapple with vaccine and therapeutic production. So I think we want to build more redundancy into supply chains. But supply chains have been very, very important, I think, in taking globalization, comparative advantage to the next level, aligning it with the logistics and technology platforms that have been put in place in the last 20 years and delivering much greater efficiency to global economic activity than we ever dreamt was imaginable. Some companies, I guess, are altering their supply chains in light of the anti-China rhetoric of the last 4 years and doing some sourcing outside of China. But for some of the high-end products that have taken years, if not decades, to develop supplier networks in China, and here I'm talking about, say, Apple and its iPhone, you don't just push a button and go from one input source to another. It's a much more difficult process than that.
Let me just briefly turn to the Biden administration's approach to China. Stephen, as you know, the Biden administration recently released just a few days ago the interim national security strategic guidance, and it has language in there, which I won't quote at length here, that lays out what the administration's goals are with respect to China in terms of dealing with, quote, cyber theft, coercive economic practices, and so on. I guess my question for you is, as we look at that document, which also talks, by the way, about the United States welcoming cooperation with China, where that makes sense for the United States and where the issues merit that. My question is, how different in your view, 7 weeks into the Biden administration, is the Biden administration's thinking about China than that of the Trump administration, based on what we see in the statements that we've seen, the interim guidance, and so on?
I think they've been very cautious, David, and they have not put their cards on the table yet. I'm a little concerned that the bipartisan negative sentiment against China in both the Republican and the Democratic Party is apparently constraining the Biden administration from a more aggressive rethinking of the policy of the last 4 years. I'd like them to start with a clean slate. Yes, there's a lot of issues that have been put on the table, especially in the innovation and technology transfer and state-owned enterprise subsidy support areas and even cyber that need to be addressed carefully. But this whole framework that was put in place a little over a year ago, the phase one deal to fixate on this bilateral trade imbalance, the framework is a faulty framework. And the sooner the Biden administration has the courage to admit that and to recognize that we need a different framework, a more multilateral global framework to address these trade issues, the better. And that would free them up and enable them to unwind these very, I think, adverse tariffs that are having a negative impact on American companies and consumers. So they need to do a major rethinking. The question is, do they have the political courage to do that at this early point in their new administration?
Stephen, I think that is right on the mark. And my sense from the outside is that I think the Biden administration and President Biden himself and other key players within the administration absolutely know what the right thing to do is from a rationality standpoint and sort of what's good for America standpoint. But the key issue is the very issue that you cited. Will this administration be able to find the courage politically to do what it knows is the right thing to do? And I think there is a big question mark about that. And I think you've really summed that up beautifully. Let me ask you one other question before kind of concluding, and that's specifically on the issue of tariffs. Stephen, as you know, both Biden and Harris on the campaign trail stated that what we know to be true, that the tariff Trump tariffs were hurting America, and the two candidates for president and vice president signaled that they would rescind them or scale them back. Do you see that happening in 2021 or even in this presidential term?
I hope that does happen. I think the tariffs had a negative impact. They backfired. They certainly were never paid by China, as the former president says. They've been paid by American businesses and to some extent by consumers. But again, it gets back to political will and political courage. The sentiment polls suggest bipartisan negative views on China. And so to roll back tariffs in that climate does pose some political risk to the Biden administration that they right now seem very wary of taking. I hope they have the courage to do the right thing rather than the politically correct thing.
I think that's the key issue to watch, and it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Stephen, before we conclude and wrap up here, let me just ask, according to recent projections, China could potentially double the size of its economy by 2035, about 14 years from now. That would imply perhaps 5% or between 5 and 6% growth per year. And China's projecting 6% growth for this year. And it could potentially surpass the United States as the world's largest economy in gross terms by 2028. Do you think China is on track to do that? And finally, what are the economic challenges confronting China over these next few years? And how prepared is China to address those challenges?
Well, that's a big question, David. Certainly China, with its population that is four times the size of the United States, can be expected, if it stays on its recent, anything close to its recent growth trajectory, to continue to move and converge to a scale that will equal, if not exceed, ours in the next 5 to 10 years. But on a per capita basis, which is much more relevant, China's still a relatively poor country, maybe 74th, 75th in terms of the rankings of GDP per capita in the world, and has a long way to go to improve its standing on that far more important metric. China's got a lot of challenges, and I would just summarize them as saying that it needs to really face up to four key transitions if it's going to stay on this path of economic growth and convergence, if not exceeding that of the United States. It needs to shift its growth structure from investment and exports to internal private consumption. It needs to shift from manufacturing to services. It needs to shift from surplus saving to saving absorption, that is, drawing its savings down to fund a social safety net that its workers need for retirement, social security, and health care. And then finally, and perhaps most controversially, it needs to shift from importing innovation to more indigenous or homegrown innovation to drive its overall efficiency or productivity higher. And China's got to do all of that and more, and especially wean itself from the debt-intensive growth that it's been on over the last decade. If it can do that, it will perform in an extraordinary way over the next 10 to 15 years. But those are big challenges for any nation, especially China.
Stephen, I just want to say I really appreciate your insights and your expertise. And obviously this year, 2021, is going to be a really interesting year in the relationship. There's never a dull year, but particularly with the Biden administration coming in and a kind of stock take of where U.S. policy toward China is, I think it's going to be a pivotal moment for the relationship and potentially an inflection point in one direction or the other. And again, Stephen, I just want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your perspectives.
Thank you, David. Thank you for your thoughtful questions. And let's keep our fingers crossed.
Absolutely. And remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. Thank you for listening.